John Bachman, who pierces people's face. The K is for the kill, L is for the lover, and the M is for the mutiny, and I wish it didn't happen.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my drum?
Now the N is for knots, oh no, my bones are sinking. The B is for the peg leg that keeps me standing up. A Q is for quantum leap, R is for the rum, and the S is for the scurvy, which I wish I didn't get.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg.
That's underneath my boat. And B is for Mukitas, who plays a sour note. W is Tiasis, X marks a spot. Why? Cause I'm a pirate.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my grog?
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 90.5 FM from Washington, D.C. If you can hear this signal and you like what you hear, send an email to WSQTRadio@hushmail.com. Repeat, WSQTRadio@hushmail.com.
Welcome to This Week in Palestine, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for March 9 to 15, 2013. Obama's first upcoming visit to Palestine and Israel as president met with lack of hope by Palestinians. Meanwhile, Israelis form a very right-wing coalition one day before legal period expires. These stories and more are coming up. Stay tuned. Let's begin our weekly report, as usual, with the non-violent activities organized in the West Bank. This week, Israeli soldiers used chemical water and tear gas to attack unarmed protesters against the Israeli wall and settlements. Protests were organized at a number of West Bank communities. IMEMC's Salam Kumsiyeh with the story.
On Friday of this week, anti-war and settlements protests were organized at the villages of Bil'in, Na'lin, and Nabi Saleh in central West Bank and Al-Masr village in the south. At the villages of Bil'in and Na'lin, villagers and their supporters managed to reach the Israeli wall built on lands taken from local farmers. Israeli troops stationed at the wall in both locations used tear gas and chemical water to force people back. Many were treated for the effects of tear gas inhalation. At the village of Nabi Saleh, soldiers stopped the march at the village entrance and used chemical water, tear gas, and rubber-coated steel bullets to force people back. Soldiers then invaded the village and fired tear gas at residents' homes. Many were treated for the effects of tear gas inhalation. Also on Friday, at Al-Masr village, southern West Bank, Israeli troops stopped the weekly anti-war protest there at the village entrance. Soldiers forced people back into the village using rifle butts and buttons to push people back. No injuries were reported. For IMEMC News, this is Salam Kumsiyeh.
Palestinians skeptical about the upcoming Obama visit. Meanwhile, Israeli right-wing factions form a coalition to form the new government. The details with IMEMC's Ghassan Bannoura.
The upcoming visit of the U.S. President Barack Obama to the region is met with a rather fluctuating attitude in the occupied Palestinian territories. It is one of the few cases where the Palestinian civil society and the Palestinian Authority are in agreement that Obama trip does not bring any hope to the region. while the Palestinian Authority is taking some security measures in preparation for the visit that was not publicly announced until Thursday, the Palestinian civil society organizations, which has a strong impact on the public opinion in Palestine, does not feel comfortable with the visit. At least 100 Palestinian non-governmental organizations have signed a letter to President Barack Obama asking him to pressure Israeli authorities during his upcoming visit to the region to end settlements on Palestinian land. The organizations stated that Obama has to work first for the immediate release of all political detainees, the removal of all Israeli barriers, more than 600 of them in the West Bank, and the end of the Gaza siege in order to achieve peace in the region. There must be a time frame for the application of the international law in order to ensure the Palestinian right of return, self-determination, and the establishment of an independent Palestinian state. Mohsen Abu Ramadan, chairman of the board of Palestinian NGO Network, stated during a press conference on Thursday. Another group of young civil society activists launched a campaign they called Obama Ahlin, meaning welcome Obama, yet in a sarcastic tone. The goal of the campaign is to try to meet with U.S. President and deliver a message that includes, but not all limited to, pursuing Israel to release all Palestinian political prisoners from its jails and an immediate end to the Israeli military occupation in the Palestinian territories occupied in 1967, in addition to other demands listed on their homepage on Facebook. In the meantime, three right-wing Israeli parties signed an agreement to form a coalition that would enable them to form the new government in Israel. The three parties are the Likud, Habayit HaYehudi, the Jewish House, and Yesh Atid, There is a Future. The new government is expected to focus on the construction of more settlements in the West Bank, which puts more nails in the coffin of the two-state solution, which is the same trend the previous government has been following. Former Israeli member of Knesset and leader of Israel's Gosh Shalom, the peace bloc, Yuri Avniri, said today, "The future has arrived and it looks suspiciously like the past. Indeed, the new policies look very much like the old policies," Avniri added. For IMEMC News, this is Ghassan Bannoura.
This week, Israeli attacks on Palestinians left one young man dead and another one critically injured, while Israeli troops conducted at least 54 military incursions into West Bank communities. During those invasions, Israeli soldiers kidnapped 31 Palestinians, including two children. IMEMC's Iman Bajali has more.
On Tuesday of this week, 25-year-old Mahmoud Attiti was shot and killed by an Israeli dum-dum bullet to the head in the Al-Fawar refugee camp in Hebron, in the southern part of the occupied West Bank. Two more Palestinians were shot by live rounds and six by rubber-coated metal bullets. Attiti died when soldiers clashed with local youth near his home. He works as an online journalist. Earlier in the week, a Palestinian child was injured on Monday afternoon when she was hit by an Israeli settler's car in occupied East Jerusalem. 9-year-old Nadine Jolies was walking home from her school when a settler hit her with his car and fled the scene, eyewitnesses told local news. Meanwhile, Palestinian teenager was seriously injured on Thursday by Israeli army fire in the Tul Karim district, in the northern part of the occupied West Bank. Local sources reported that the army invaded the area and opened fire at a number of residents, seriously wounding one Palestinian identified as Hamza Haloub, 18. A Red Crescent ambulance rushed to the scene and moved Haloub to a hospital in Tul Karim. He suffered a gunshot injury to the lung. Earlier on Thursday, Palestinian medical sources in Nablus, in the northern part of the occupied West Bank, reported that dozens of Palestinians have been treated for the effects of tear gas inhalation after the army invaded Talfit nearby village and clashed with local youth. In the Gaza Strip this week, Israeli forces conducted two limited invasions targeting border areas in the coastal enclave. On Monday, army tanks and bulldozers invaded areas close to Gaza City and destroyed farmlands. Later on Thursday, Israeli tanks and bulldozers uprooted trees and destroyed farmlands at the southern Gaza borders with Israel. Moreover, on Thursday, Israeli Navy opened fire at Palestinian fishing boats, causing damage but no injuries. For IMEMC News, this is Iman Bajali.
That's all for today from This Week in Palestine. This was the weekly report for March 9 to the 15th, 2013, from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please keep visiting our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by Hussam Qassis and me, George Rishmal.
Afghanistan, 14th of March, U.S. General Joseph F. Dunford Jr. ordered his troops to go on alert after Afghan President Karzai condemned the United States for things like harassing Afghan students at universities and trying to delay the handover of the notorious prison at Bagram Air Base. General Dunford issued a threat alert saying the decision by the President of Afghanistan to stand up to U.S. bullying could inspire both insider and conventional insurgent attacks. He considered the references to Bagram particularly likely to inspire fighters. Afghanistan, 15th of March. A massive truck bomb that could have destroyed a whole section of Kabul was found and defused. A night raid in eastern Kabul found 8 tons, that's 16,000 pounds of explosives in the truck. That's 5 times the initial estimated yield of the Oklahoma City truck bomb that trashed 5 buildings and damaged a total of 312 buildings in addition to the Murrah building. Pakistan, 12th of March. A suicide bombing of a police van and subsequent gun battle killed 2 police officials and 1 other person and wounded 20 people in Banu district of Khyber Pakhtunkhwa province. Mr. Barack Obama, this war just goes on and on with no end in sight. Don't wait until 2014. Bring all the troops and all the drones home today. On the 9th of March, protesters gathered on Dolly Madison Boulevard in front of the headquarters of the CIA in Langley, Virginia. They were there to protest a growing menace of CIA drone strikes, foreign and possibly domestic in the future. Just like the previous 4 times, police yellow-taped off the entrance and shut it down.
I also want to thank the CIA, I don't know if they're police or whatever, because they've done something that we've been trying to tell people about. They put tape around, making the CIA a crime scene. So thank you. Thank you, guys.
2 weeks ago, Code Pink and people from Pakistan and other peace people from the community had an opportunity to go into the Pakistan embassy to meet with Ambassador Rahman, and she stated unequivocally Pakistan's opposition to the drone strikes on international law grounds and that it's a violation of Pakistan's sovereignty.
That there should not be any ambiguity about the fact that Pakistan is very clearly against the whole business of drone attacks on its territory. We see them as against the law. We consider them a violation of our sovereignty.
And at the end, I had an opportunity to express an apology on behalf of the people of this country for the war crimes that are being committed in Pakistan and to ask forgiveness for these crimes, and to share the resistance that is going on around the country to this murderous policy, including the witness of Brian Terrell, who is serving a 6-month prison sentence at Yankton, South Dakota Federal Prison for his action of going on to Whitman Air Force Base in Missouri, calling for an end to the drone strikes, and the witness that was read by Judith Kelly of the 9 friends who were arrested on Ash Wednesday at Hancock Air Force Base.
Picture this. 3 children who stand surrounded by the debris of their former home a few hours after it was obliterated by a Hellfire missile fired from a CIA drone in the early hours of August 23rd, 2010. When photographer Noor Bahram reached the children a few hours later, he said, "The children were shocked, but had at least survived the blast. Their father, Bismillah, their mother, and 8 and 10-year-old brothers had been blown to pieces by the strike. The orphan children and their dead loved ones became the latest civilian victims of a U.S. war against Pakistani militancy in which they had played no part.
Afghan teenager Basha Zarino was collecting firewood when a drone missile struck and killed two Taliban commanders last fall. Shrapnel from the attack hit Zarina. She died while being rushed to a hospital a half an hour away. According to the Los Angeles Times, Zarina is one of the civilian victims of over 500 drone strikes in Afghanistan in 2012, an over 70% increase from the year before, as U.S. military commanders increasingly rely on unmanned aircraft to kill insurgents. The Pentagon is in the process of reducing the number of U.S. combat troops in Afghanistan in preparation for the major drawdown in 2014. Drone operations are increasingly controversial on Capitol Hill. Kentucky Senator Rand Paul delayed the confirmation of John Brennan, President Obama's nominee to head the CIA, with a rare old-style 13-hour filibuster. Paul and other legislators were concerned about the Obama administration's earlier refusal to rule out a drone strike against Americans on American soil. Under pressure, U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder eventually ruled out such an attack on American territory if that person did not pose an imminent threat. Drone strikes, ordered by the executive branch with no known oversight or checks and balances, increasingly rely on intelligence signatures or subjective observations such as the movement of trucks or groups of armed men, rather than requiring positive identification of targeted individuals. During the recent debate, U.S. Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina said that an estimated 4,700 people have been killed in America's drone war over the last decade, the first time a government official has offered a total number of fatalities caused by drone strikes.
On the 13th of March, U.S. President Barack Obama held a fundraiser at the St. Regis Hotel in a 900 block of 16th Street, closing down 16th Street and K Street for blocks. Protesters outside opposed pay-for-play political access, the murder of people in Pakistan and elsewhere with drones, and especially the Keystone XL tar sands pipeline. Get the drones out. People protesting at an Obama fundraiser. On the other side of the street, no, that's 350.org, no KXL. The cops telling pedestrians they can't cross the street to where they're having a fundraiser. That's abusive policing. What are you going to do about it? Writing a jaywalking ticket that can't be collected in D.C.'s courts? Look at all these cop cars. Yeah. They're closing down K Street in rush hour so that Obama can have a fundraiser in a St. Regis in the 900 block of 16th Street. I can't afford your $500,000 for representation, organized for access.
For only $400,000 for rubber chicken, I can do it. $500,000.
Stop the dirty pipeline plan! Barack Obama, yes we can! Stop the dirty pipeline plan! Barack Obama, yes we can!
We don't believe your hype.
We don't want this leaky pipe.
We don't believe your hype.
Woo! We don't want this leaky pipe. All pipelines fail. Tar sands oil kills.
All pipelines fail.
Tar sands oil kills.
There it is. He's coming. 350.org and the other opponents of the Keystone XL tar sands pipeline were chanting, "Stop the pipeline, yes we can," as Obama's motorcade made the short trip up 16th Street, turned right on K Street, and disappeared into a little tent so Obama could get out and go to a fundraiser for $500,000 donors without being seen by the public.
We'll be right back.
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 90.5 FM from Washington, D.C. If you can hear this signal and you like what you hear, send an email to WSQTradio@hushmail.com. Repeat, WSQTradio@hushmail.com. In Brooklyn, New York City, police have twice met protests against their shooting and murder of yet another unarmed teenager with riot police, mass arrests, and brutal force. Here's a report from the front lines.
Okay, YouTube, just sitting here watching a Ustream link. It is of a protest in New York. It's a channel on Ustream called On the Front Lines. I'll leave a link in the description below. Last night, Russia Today were reporting that there was a protest. Basically, there was a 16-year-old boy shot. I believe his name is Kimari Gray. 2 seconds. Yeah, Kimani Gray. He's a 16-year-old boy. Witnesses are saying he was unarmed and he was basically gunned down. But it's not an isolated incident, seemingly. So, people are back on the streets again tonight. I'll just show you here. Okay, oh. And hopefully you can hear that there. The police helicopter's out. It's kind of reminiscent of the old Occupy movement days. Makes me wonder why there isn't more protesting right now. Things have got a whole lot worse since that. I was going to say uprising, it wasn't exactly that. But since that movement got off the ground, I feel things have got a lot harder, a lot harsher. Yet we don't see as much protesting now. The one thing we need to be careful though, protests like this, agent provocateurs, we know DHS in America has bought now over 2 billion rounds. Their police departments like NYPD are also buying light armoured vehicles. So agent provocateurs is going to be something they need to look out for here, because when you have a build-up of ammunition and hardware such as the Americans seem to be doing right now, it's primed for a false flag to crack down on other protesters. And anyone basically who wants to speak out against the authorities and the government. Okay, so like I say, I'll leave the link in the description below, but here they are again, folks.
16-year-old Kimani Gray, Kimani Gray, it's also a hashtag, was killed, I think on 55th Street and Church Avenue. Last night, there was another protest, which got a little out of hand, and there's going to be a vigil and demonstrations in memory of Kimani Gray every night of this week.
Okay, so there you go. I hope you heard that there. There's going to be vigils every night this week. They're protesting the death, obviously, of this young lad. Says there was a lot of trouble last night. So, yeah, this could be something worth watching, guys. This could grow into something bigger. If you remember the riots down in England, London, Manchester, Birmingham, that was all over a young man who was shot by police. Look what that developed into. Okay, later YouTube.
That was recorded live as protests and police repression took place right outside the speaker's window. A former gang member, now a community activist, interviewed by Russia Today, said the New York police were essentially ignoring all law and becoming a law of their own.
Merle, what's happening in Brooklyn earlier, I was joined by Sean Duke McFadder. He's a former gang member, but now he's a community activist and the executive director of Gangsters Making Astronomical Community Changes, Inc. I first asked him to tell us a little bit about what the people in Brooklyn are feeling and thinking these days.
The emotions are different. It depends on what side you're coming from. You know, when you're dealing with the family and the community, you know, they just want answers for their child, for their loved one. And when you're dealing with most of the people within the community that's not the family, their anger comes from the fact that the police are constantly killing people in these streets. It's been a lot of that in Flatbush, but just the fact that they feel that the police are shooting people and not, you know, being held accountable.
And it seems to me that this is more than just this one case, that the community has kind of reached a boiling point there. Can you tell us what has led up to this? Can you describe the relationship between the police and the community?
Well, there is no relationship. If you ask for a description of the relationship, the best description you can get is they're the police, the community is the community, and what the police says goes, and that's it. They don't want to listen to the voice of the community. They're just coming out and they're unleashing their own laws.
Like, I want to ask you, because we are seeing these reports of protesters throwing bottles and other objects. One officer says that he was hit by a brick and was injured. And I understand that people are angry, but is turning to violence the way to bring about change and to bring attention to this?
No, that's far from the message. If you pay attention to what happened today, there was a press conference today, and the sole reason for the press conference was called by Jumaane Williams was to bring attention to the violence, was to bring attention to the fact that there was bottles thrown, people were arrested, and it's going in a violent direction. That's not the whole purpose of what the organizations are out there doing. We have people that's outside of the community that's coming in, and they have their causes, their agendas, but it's not working well with what the community wants or what the community don't want. So the answer to it is, how do we come up with a plan of action that keeps the especially the young people, that's who are the ones who are the most angry, because they're dealing with someone their age, so for them it feels like they could be shot down tomorrow. So when they come out angry, feel like a loved one or a friend has been shot down, then you have the wrong person come out and voice the wrong message, it causes them to feel like this is the direction that they want to go in. If you bring the right message to them, they'll follow in that way.
Okay, what would you and other protesters there over in Brooklyn, what would you like to see happen?
Right now, first and foremost, even we want the answers from the police department, from what happened. We want some type of we want someone persecuted. We want someone taken to court and tried for those charges. But before we get to that, we first have to get our community down to the level of speaking without causing some type of violent action to police. We're not at war with the police. We don't want to get to perceive as if the community is at war with the police, because that's not going to give us a good reaction from the community and from those who want to help. So right now, it's just about bringing the youth down, getting them to realize that there's community leaders out here that's working to get an answer for what happened to Kamani Gray and others.
And lastly, I want to ask you, because police say that they opened fire on Kamani Gray after the suspect pointed a loaded gun at them. But I understand that there's people in the community that dispute this. What is the understanding there? What do people believe happened over in Brooklyn?
We're getting a lot of different, chain of events as far as how it came down to them being shot. But based on what the community is saying, that he didn't, first of all, if he did in fact have that gun, he never knew that those were police officers, what they're saying. The police never identified themselves to no one within that area. The police jumped out of the vehicle and freeze, don't move, whatever statements that they made didn't identify themselves as police. According to what we've learned, he was shot in the back. Mm-hmm. So if he was pointing a gun at the police officers, detectives, how did he end up with bullets in his back? Which means he was retreating, he was running away from those he thought was coming at him.
Okay, yeah, certainly a lot of questions. Hopefully you do get some answers. That was Sean Duke McFadder, executive director of Gangsters Making Astronomical Community Changes, Inc.
Athens, Greece. Anarchists firebombed the main police station in the Acropolis on the 10th of March. The incendiary device burned two motorcycles and the guard post. This action was carried out in memory of Lambros Foundas, a member of the revolutionary struggle and anarchist movement who 3 years ago was shot and killed by police during an armed battle in the streets of Athens. This communique was posted to www.anarchistnews.org. Quote, "All men dream, but not equally. Those who dream by night in the dusty recesses of their minds wake in the day to find it was vanity, but the dreamers of the day are dangerous men, for they may act their dreams with open eyes to make it possible." T. E. Lawrence. This we did inspired by dreams of rage, but above all dreams of memory, and so we attacked the Acropolis police station in the early hours of March 10th, 2013, catching the crowds of cops in the area off guard. The reasons are many. The loss of Lambros is the greater reason of all. 3 years have passed already from that night of March 10th when Lambros Foundas, flesh of the anarchist movement and a revolutionary struggle member, fell in armed battle with the pigs of the Greek police in the district of Daphne, Athens. His life and death set an example that no fighter of freedom will ever be able to forget. We cannot allow tears to be shed for our dead comrades, but we bear a responsibility to be taught from the faith, dedication, and consistency of their struggle. We bear a responsibility to honor the memory of Lambros Foundas by any means, reflecting on the path of his political course of action, and hence his very own life. May hands reach out and grip his gun. We bid another, yet certainly not our last audio to him, saying, "Lambros, revolutionaries will continue to grow the flower which bloomed at dawn in Daphne until victory." So ends the communique posted to Anarchist News concerning the firebombing of the main police station in Athens, Greece. On the 13th of March, the anti-gentrification front in Vancouver, Canada, smashed the windows at an upscale pizza joint. They also trashed two city-owned trucks and one 18-wheeler tractor over the previous week to directly interfere in upscale construction projects. This communique was posted to www.anarchistnews.org. Anti-gentrification front strikes again. For all too long now, yuppies have been peacefully going about their gourmet dinners, buying up their lucky condos, and flaunting their wealth by driving around in expensive cars. We thought it would be great to remind them AGF is still here. So last night, for the third time, Formosa Neapolitan Pizzeria was attacked. Several of its windows and one of its cameras were smashed. Formosa thought that putting up their pathetic cameras would stop our attacks. They haven't and never will. We are also inspired by the picketers of the new yuppie restaurant in the downtown east side called Pigeon. They have been giving yuppies a taste of the class war for weeks now. Over the last week, City of Vancouver, who promotes gentrification with their Grandview Woodland Community Plan, were also visited by the AGF. Two of their trucks had their windows smashed, six altogether, including two windshields, and one of their tractors had their huge windows shattered. This is a fucking class war, and we will not stop until we are free from class, the state, and all others who oppress us. Your time has come. Pigeon, it's time you fly away or face the consequences. AGF. That ends a communique posted to Anarchist News for the attacks on gentrification projects in Vancouver by the Anti-Gentrification Front in the second week of March.
Alone. No more nights. Blood and fire.
13th of March, the Bank of Vancouver had all their windows smashed as punishment for their support for coal mining. This communique was published at www.anarchistnews.org. Last night, the Bank of Montreal had all their windows smashed. This branch was located on 2515 East Hastings, Vancouver, in so-called British Columbia. BMO was targeted not only because it is a symbol of capitalism, but because it banks with Compliance Energy Corporation. They're in the coal industry. They're in the business of destroying the land, the water, and the wildlife. After all, they are capitalist assholes that don't care about you or me. Compliance Energy Corporation plans to dig up over 28,000 hectares of land stretching from Fannie Bay to Campbell River, and its claims are even more. It is looking at both underground and open pit mining. With the Raven Mine, the company plans to extract 30 million tons of raw coal in the next 16 years, shipping out 13 million tons, and leaving behind 17 million tons of potentially acid-generating rejects in the hills above Bain Sound. This has to be stopped. This will be stopped. Bank of Montreal, you will be attacked again and again until you are nothing. Raven Mine will fail. Compliance Energy will fail. Anarchists are always watching, and we will not back down. We will never back down. Fuck Raven Mine. Fuck Bank of Montreal. For the end of all resource extraction, A. This ends a communique with the attack on Bank of Vancouver by anarchists opposing coal mining on Anarchist News. Of action against the Keystone XL tar sands pipeline has begun early. On the 11th of March, over 100 people stormed TransCanada's office in Westboro, Massachusetts, holding a funeral for our future. They were there in opposition to the Keystone XL tar sands pipeline and carried a black casket emblazoned with the words, "Our Future." Others carried flowers like you would see at a normal funeral. Twenty-six people were arrested when they refused police demands to leave. The rest continued the funeral procession outside, chanting, "We will lay down our bodies, we will lay down our souls. No, we won't stand by and watch while they dig us a hole." Will Pearl is a Tufts University freshman arrested in this action, and he had this to say, quote, "If the tar sands are extracted and burned, it will wipe out my future and the future of my entire generation." Continuing, "If President Obama will not reject the Keystone XL pipeline, we will stop it ourselves. We will rise up and resist, from the backwoods of Texas to corporate offices in Massachusetts to the steps of the White House."
They are digging us a hole.
When students and youth near Boston stormed a TransCanada office in opposition to the Keystone XL tar sands pipeline, their "Funeral for Our Future" featured this song.
"Will go. They are digging us a hole. They are digging us a hole. 6 feet underground, where our future will go. We will lay down our bodies, we will lay down our souls. No, we won't stand by and watch while they dig us a hole. They are digging us a hole, they are digging us a hole. 6 feet underground where the pipeline will go. They are digging us a hole. by and watch while they dig us a hole. They are digging us a hole. They are digging us a hole. 6 feet underground where the pipeline will go.
This funeral march and song was quite a strong vow of continuing direct action resistance to the tar sands pipeline. 26 people were arrested inside the TransCanada office. All of them were released by the next morning.
In the current environment of the fiscal cliff and sequester program cuts, the $10 to $52 billion of taxpayer-funded subsidies received annually by the nation's largest oil and gas companies remains off the table and immune to cuts in congressional budget negotiations. With so many politicians' election campaigns being bankrolled by big oil, it's not hard to explain why the most profitable industry in the history of the planet still receives a fortune in government handouts. A similar display of the raw power of the fossil fuel industry can be seen in the decades-long deadlock on U.S. policy to address climate change. Apart from occasional political rhetoric about the threat of climate change, Washington has not initiated any credible initiatives to reduce the nation's carbon emissions linked to global warming. A new documentary film that investigates the power and influence of the fossil fuel industry exposes the funding provided by Big Oil to a network of climate change deniers who charge that global warming is a myth. The film Greedy Lying Bastards, directed by Craig Scott Roseborough and produced by actor and climate activist Daryl Hannah, illustrates a deliberate campaign of disinformation designed to confuse the public and create doubt about the need for government action to address climate change. Through interviews with climate scientists, AstroTurf activists funded by the Koch brothers and ExxonMobil, and people around the world whose lives have been devastated by floods, drought, and wildfires linked with rising temperatures, the film makes a powerful case for grassroots mobilization to challenge the power and influence of the fossil fuel industry. Your reporter spoke with Greedy Lying Bastards director Scott Roseborough, who talks about the film's message and how he hopes information presented in the documentary can be used as an organizing tool within the emerging international climate change movement.
You know, Scott, there's really two different categories of individuals that make up the climate change denial campaign. And that are the frontmen, you know, the people that we see on the likes of Fox News that are really spreading purposely the misinformation. And then there's the funders, where those guys are getting their money. And so they are working hand in hand and have been for a number of years now to ensure that we are confused about the issue and that our congressmen do pretty much nothing about it. So our all-time, you know, number one funder of climate change denialists in the world is Koch Industries, the Koch brothers, David and Charles Koch. They have been notorious in their funding. In the last decade alone, they've spent over $67 million to basically confuse the public on the issue of climate change. So the second funder, you know, in terms of all-time funding towards the climate change denial campaign, is ExxonMobil. And Exxon, you know, has tried or at least has given lip service over the years to stop their funding of skeptics and climate change deniers, but they continue to do so. And those two are some of the largest funders and kind of the make up the backbone of that denial campaign. Now, on the front side of it, we have individuals like Christopher Monckton or Tim Phillips. James Inhofe, even a senator from Oklahoma. All these individuals have gone out of their way to really put the focus upon them, getting on Fox News, sometimes CNN, and really with the purposeful goal of causing doubt, creating doubt about the issue of climate change. None of these individuals have a scientific background. They're not climate scientists, but Fox News will routinely put them on the air, sometimes alone or sometimes next to a climate scientist, to give the viewpoint that there is a debate on the issue. Well, if you ask the peer-reviewed, credible scientists on the issue, they believe there is no debate. The debate is over. There is a consensus that climate change is happening, and of course that we need to do something about it. So it's a very powerful campaign, and one that is up until recently been very potent in convincing the American public, especially, that there's no need to do anything on this particular issue. thanks to the severe weather patterns that we've seen in the last couple of years with the droughts and the wildfires and, of course, Hurricane Sandy, you know, we couldn't ask for a better time to release this film because public opinion has now come back around to see the logic in the science and ask and pressure their lawmakers into doing something.
As executive producer, Daryl Hannah, I'm sure, played a critical role in terms of the shape of the film, and she's long known as an activist on many issues. What's been the reaction in the premieres that you've had over the last couple of months and with the release of the film on March 8th? What kind of reaction have you had specifically from environmental groups and on?
Widespread support, Scott. Widespread support. Greenpeace has got on board. They've been promoting it heavily. Actually, Kurt Davies, the head of research for Greenpeace USA, wrote a blog today on Huffington's Green page talking about the film and praising the film and with the desire of getting the message out there as far as possible. Last night, I was at a screening of the film in Santa Monica, California, and did a question and answer session, and there were members of Sierra Club there that had brought a number of people. And we're getting a lot of response from local, you know, smaller, more regional organizations around the United States and even internationally. Very excited about the film, very excited either they've seen it or they want to see it, or how do we get our hands on it? So I think there is an urgency to the issue. There is a very timeliness to the issue. And I think that, you know, for me, one of the goals of the film was first to educate the public on how deceitful the campaign is to deny climate change. But then once we get that message out there, we really have to turn that education into action. You know, we have to make sure that our Congress people are listening to real scientists and not these industry-paid climate change denialists.
That was Craig Scott Roseborough, director of the new film Greedy Lying Bastards. For more information about the film, visit our Between the Lines website.
Arizona day laborers won a major victory in the 9th District U.S. Court of Appeals, which upheld an injunction against a specific section of the state's immigration law, SB 1070, that prohibits people from stopping cars to hire day laborers if it creates a traffic jam. 9th District Federal Judge Raymond Fisher ruled that the language on day laborers and traffic seemed to be motivated by a desire to eliminate the livelihoods of undocumented immigrants. Pablo Alvarado of the National Day Labor Organizing Network hailed the ruling, declaring it is fundamentally wrong to criminalize work, to criminalize people who are looking for work to feed their families. Arizona Attorney General Tom Horn pledged to appeal the case to the U.S. Supreme Court, claiming the state legislature acted properly to protect the safety of drivers and pedestrians. Public nuisance and anti-loitering laws have often been used to marginalize poor communities and limit their access to the public square, and to provide authorities with an excuse to surveil and harass community organizers. Raul Alcaraz Ochoa of Tucson, Arizona's Southside Day Labor Center says the ruling shines a light on how profit and exploitation under capitalism are central to the national immigration debate.